on this edition for Saturday, April 17th. Continuing protests and renewed calls for police training reforms in the wake of more police shootings. Another grim milestone as global deaths from COVID-19 surpassed 3 million. And a final farewell to Prince Philip, next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfein Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. In cities across the country last night, there were large protests against police-involved shootings. In Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside a police station to protest the death of 20-year-old Dante Wright. Wright was shot and killed by a police officer last Sunday during an attempt to arrest him for an outstanding warrant. Protests have been held in Brooklyn Center every day since then. In Chicago, hundreds gathered to protest the police shooting of 13-year-old Adam Toledo last month. Recently released body camera footage shows Toledo was shot by a police officer less than a second after he appeared to drop a handgun, turn around, and began to raise his hands. And in Portland, Oregon last night, protests turned violent after police there shot and killed an unidentified man in his 30s yesterday afternoon. Authorities declared a riot and used pepper spray to disperse the crowd. We will have more on the recent shootings and police training after the news summary. In Indiana last night, the Marion County Coroner's Office released the names of the 8 people killed in a mass shooting at an Indianapolis FedEx facility on Thursday. At least 4 of the victims were members of the Sikh community. The youngest, Samaria Blackwell, and Carly Smith were both 19. Matthew R. Alexander was 32. Amarjit Sakhan was 48. Amarjit Johal, Jaswinder Kaur, and Jaswinder Singh were all in their 60s, and the oldest victim was 74-year-old John Weiser. Vigils are planned throughout the weekend. This was the 6th mass shooting in the U.S. in the last 5 weeks. The 19-year-old gunman, who reportedly killed himself in Thursday's mass shooting, had been on law enforcement's radar. According to the FBI, the gunman was placed on a, quote, mental health temporary hold last year after his mother contacted police over concerns that he might attempt, quote, suicide by cop. Police say they searched items in his room at the time and removed a shotgun, which was not returned. Lawrence Andrea, public safety and breaking news reporter for the Indianapolis Star, has been covering the shooting. I spoke with him earlier today from Indianapolis. Do police have any reason to believe that this was motivated in any way or that it was random? I mean, do they have computers? Have they checked his web history, social media accounts?
Well, authorities on Friday searched his home and did remove desktop computers and other electronics. But regarding the March 2020 incident, they said that they found no racially motivated extremism in that particular incident, but have not released any motive behind Thursday's shooting.
What do we know about how the victims and their families, I should say, are dealing with this now? I know 4 of the victims were members of the Sikh community, which I can't imagine is that enormous in the Indianapolis area.
Yeah. Well, the Sikh coalition said that there are about 10,000 Sikh Americans in Indiana, about 5,000 in central Indiana. We're still you know, learning more about these victims and who they were. That'll be something that I know we're working on today, and we're going to be working on it for quite some time.
How is the overall community dealing with this? I mean, this is just the most recent, and unfortunately, even the language that's used in the press conferences. We have another tragic day. This is another instance. Are people numb to this now?
I don't think people are numb to it. You know, it's certainly shaken the city. And the third mass shooting just this year, you know, we had the January 24th shooting that left five dead, including a pregnant woman. And then the March 13th shooting where four others were killed. It's something that the city is dealing with, and something that the state and the nation are also trying to deal with right now.
Lawrence Andrea of the Indianapolis Tribune, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
COVID-19 has now claimed more than 3 million lives worldwide. To put that in context, that's more than the entire population of Chicago. Johns Hopkins University posted the grim statistic today, reporting that more than 566,000 of those deaths were in the United States, with Brazil, Mexico, and India all reporting more than 175,000 deaths each. In India, there is a new stay-at-home order this weekend. In New Delhi, authorities reported more than 19,000 new infections and 141 deaths in the city on Thursday, a record high since the pandemic began. Lockdowns and curfews are also in effect in many other Indian cities as the country experiences a resurgence of coronavirus infections. COVID-19 vaccinations are rolling out erratically worldwide. The New York Times tracking project shows more than 878 million doses administered, but some countries have not yet given a single dose. In the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports more than 127 million people have received at least one dose of a vaccine as of yesterday. A pause on the use of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine is expected to continue through next week. There are reports of fewer than 10 cases of blood clots, but it's not known if the cases were directly related to the vaccine. 7.8 million doses of the J&J single-dose vaccine have been administered in the U.S. We'll have more on vaccine rollout efforts later in the program. For more international and national news, visit pbs.org/newshour. Britain's Prince Philip was laid to rest today at Windsor Castle. The Duke of Edinburgh and husband to Queen Elizabeth II died last Friday at the age of 99. His coffin was carried to St. George's Chapel on the grounds of the castle in a Land Rover he personally designed. Members of the royal family, including the heir to the throne, Prince Charles, walked behind. The Queen, who is 94, followed by Carr. There was a military ceremony outside the chapel for Philip, a veteran of the British Royal Navy. Coronavirus restrictions limited attendance at the service inside to 30 people who sat 6 feet apart.
We are here today in St. George's Chapel to commit into the hands of God the soul of his servant Prince Philip.
Philip was Britain's longest-serving consort, having been married to Queen Elizabeth for 73 years.
In the name of the Holy Spirit.
Special correspondent Ryan Chilcote has been following today's funeral and tributes to Prince Philip. Ryan, this was a day that would have had thousands of people on the streets, if not more, but that's not what we saw.
It isn't what we saw, and the reason for that is because of COVID-19 and the restrictions that continue in the UK. You know, it's just 5 days ago that stores were allowed to open in the UK. They've been closed for months, but there are still restrictions on funerals. No more than 30 people are allowed, so the royal family kept to that. There were 30 people inside the chapel. The Queen had to sit by herself. No singing was allowed because that's only allowed, the choristers are the only people that are allowed to sing. So the royal family did all of this because that is the rules, and they obviously wanted to conform to the rules, particularly because, you know, this country's been in lockdown for so long and people have had to deal with so many deaths and in so many cases alone that I think that they felt that this was the appropriate way to do this. Remember, more than 127,000 people have passed away from COVID since the pandemic began here in the UK. And an awful lot of those people had to go with through funerals without, you know, everyone that they would have liked to see at it.
And it's interesting to see that image of the Queen by herself, because so many of the people that you're talking about who had to mourn their loved ones couldn't have a funeral in any traditional sense of the word.
That's right. And, you know, the Queen, I think it was remarkable in many ways. The Queen is just 4 days from her 95th birthday. Prince Philip was 99. You know, they have been separated from many people for the length of the pandemic, sitting it out in Windsor Palace, perhaps not the worst place to be in lockdown, but nonetheless. And the whole nation has just been through an extraordinary amount of pain because, like in the United States, there have been an extraordinary number of COVID deaths. And perhaps unlike many places in the United States, in the UK at least, the restrictions continue. And it's still very difficult to gather in groups. So right now in the UK, you can have people at your home, but only in your backyard. They're not actually allowed to spend time inside of your home. And the number of deaths has really fallen off. So everyone's saying, we can't wait to open up, but the government's saying, we have to be careful. This is gonna go on, these restrictions, for another month, even two, because we can't let COVID come back in a big way.
Why does the monarchy still resonate with the British people?
It doesn't resonate with everyone, but I think it does resonate with the majority of the British people. And the reason for that is because they sort of co-associate themselves with being British, right? They do all of these things that are kind of the things that you would expect in the United States a president to do, you know, sort of show the flag, if you will. They do all of these activities. Prince Philip, who was not king, right? He was husband of Queen Elizabeth. Even he, in his limited role, because he wasn't king, just husband of a queen, did 22,000 events he attended in his life. He was part of 680 organizations. So they really go out of their way to make sure that they are kind of being good statesmen and leading the country. Witness today with the funeral, the fact that they stuck to the rules, didn't have more than the 30 that the government allows. And I think that that's why they still resonate, because they sort of embody Britishness, if you will. And that is why they've been able to preserve the monarchy, I think. And also by staying out of politics, because that would be very unwelcome here in the UK.
Ryan Shilko, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
The Derek Chauvin trial and the police shootings of Dante Wright and Adam Toledo have renewed conversations on police training and de-escalation tactics. But despite mandates for training reform, roadblocks remain, often with the officers tasked with the training. Last year, the Marshall Project reviewed 10 large city police departments and the records of their field training officers. Simone Weisselbaum, a staff writer with the Marshall Project, joined me from New York to discuss their findings. Simone, something that's been a little distressing in the last few cases of police actions against individuals is the role that trainers play. What is a field trainer for people who aren't familiar with it?
So after you graduate the academy, you're not just a cop on the street, you're actually on probation. And you spend a couple weeks or a couple months, in some places up to a year, following a veteran officer. And that person sort of becomes your teacher of the streets. That is a person who actually tells you, hey, more or less, forget everything you learned at the academy. This is the way it goes, kid.
In the case of Derek Chauvin, he was a trainer. In the situation with Kim Potter, she was a trainer. Is there something that distinguishes these individuals to get that position, to be a mentor?
Sadly, there's not much. You would think in most professions, to become a mentor, to become a trainer, you go through rigorous vetting, you go through some sort of training. In policing, that's not always the case. I only found one police department in my research on this, a place in Texas, that actually has rigorous training to become an FTO. This has been a long-stemming problem in policing. Field trainers are just treated like a regular cop, but they have special powers.
What kind of powers?
They are molding the minds of our next generation. So if you think about what happened with Derek Chauvin, a field trainer, the defense of those cops at the scene, why did they intervene? Well, they said, that was our FTO. That was our trainer. We're learning from him. We didn't really feel comfortable to say, hey, stop doing this. And that's their defense right now.
In your research last year, you were looking back beyond George Floyd. How far back does this go?
Well, this goes back to my research, at least to the early 2000s. The way I was flagged to this, I have done stories looking at consent decrees and how they're implemented via DOJ. And a common thread is FTO. We have to change the way these folks are trained, how they're paid, who we're choosing. And departments, Baltimore has actually answered that. Baltimore and their Freddie Gray case, the gentleman driving that van was an FTO. Also, another cop had seen with the Freddie Gray, his trainer testified too that, yes, we did not teach them the proper way of strapping in a suspect. So I say this because if you go back into consent decrees for more than 10 years, this has been flagged. It also came up in the Tamir Rice case.
Is there a way for you or anyone to be able to search through all of these incidents? I mean, does there exist any kind of a repository?
There is no repository, sadly. I mean, they're not really repositories on how much use of force is used. We're working on a story now looking at how is force even defined? A kick in one city may not equal force in another city, is what we're finding in our next project that's coming out in May. So, of course, if you don't even know how to define use of force, how are you going to have a database looking at who's a field trainer? And that's a big problem. I think people don't understand in our country, we have 18,000 police departments. We don't have a national police force, so we don't really have national standards.
Do police officers or field trainers have to be kind of up on what the latest restraint tactics are, what's a reasonable hold and what's not?
Most police officers have to go through sometimes 40 hours at least a year, learning how to, you know, fire their gun, new tactics like de-escalation. That's a big buzzword right now. But what I found for FTOs, they're not necessarily going through even more training. For the most part, I found to become an FTO, you need about 3 to 5 years experience at least, a clean record for up to 3 years. So what we found, Derek Chauvin had several cases and complaints of use of force during his nearly 20-year status as a police officer. But by those standards, they really only look at 3 to 5 years of your past history. So they're not necessarily hiring trainers who have clean records.
What is something that police departments can do to try to reform the system?
Well, the first thing I would, if I had a magic wand, is to hire police trainers who have clean records. Also have more incentives. Who wants to do it? What is that incentive? And based on my reporting, I found sort of these macho cops who want to pass off the macho culture to the next generation. You're not getting necessarily those who want to teach, and especially those who want to teach de-escalation.
Simone Weitzelbaum of the Marshall Project, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With now more than 127 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccination administered in the United States, there are still questions of efficacy as new strains and some breakthrough infections emerge. I spoke recently with ProPublica's Caroline Chen about those concerns and the latest vaccination efforts. Caroline, one of the things that's disconcerting right now is these breakthrough infections, people who have been vaccinated who are still coming down with COVID-19. Why is it happening?
The first thing I would say is that no vaccine is 100%. And so we have to remember that. And what was actually tested in the trials was their ability to stop symptomatic COVID. And so, as we all know, there is always a chance for asymptomatic infection. And you add on to that the fact that the vaccines are very good, but not 100%. And what that means is just that breakthrough infections are going to occur. And that's expected by everyone. That's not surprising. The part that we are maybe concerned about is those extremely, extremely rare cases where somebody is fully vaccinated but still gets hospitalized or has severe COVID. Because one of the hopes for the vaccine was that, you know, even if you do have an infection post-vaccination, it'll like reduce it so you barely have symptoms or you have a cold. That would be a win for us, right? So if every single breakthrough infection was mild or asymptomatic, that'd be a win. But unfortunately, there have been very, very, very rare cases. I'm talking about 0.0005% of people who have been fully vaccinated, in which people do end up still getting hospitalized.
So the CDC recently came out with some numbers saying of the people that they tested that were vaccinated, about 5,800 people got infected, and only about 7% or so ended up dying. How do we make sure that people recognize the rarity of this, that this is not a reason to hesitate in getting the vaccine?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually think that 7% number, which is technically accurate, is a little misleading, because it's 7% of those people who had a breakthrough infection who ended up being hospitalized. The real denominator that I think is important to people is how many percent of those who actually were fully vaccinated ended up hospitalized. That's what you want to know. What are my chances of being fully hospitalized even after I've been fully vaccinated? And that's the 0.0005% that I cited earlier. So extremely rare. And you have to then think about, again, your risk benefit. You know, if you were not vaccinated and you caught COVID, look, what are your chances of getting COVID? And what are your chances of then being hospitalized? Versus if you are fully vaccinated, your chances of getting COVID lower dramatically, then your chances of that being hospitalization case is even lower. So there's still a clear benefit to being vaccinated.
Johnson & Johnson vaccine, at this point, still a pause, likely to be unpaused?
I really would hope that it will be unpaused, because this is a really important vaccine, not just for the US, but for the world. We've talked so much about the cold storage requirements of Moderna and Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson has some advantages in that it doesn't require this ultra cold storage. It's just one shot. It's also cheap. Johnson & Johnson has promised to provide it on a nonprofit basis. So we do need this vaccine in the world. Right now, it is a very small percentage of the supply in the US. So, the pause is not going to mean that like suddenly everybody can't get vaccinations. But I think it is going to be really critical for scientists to understand, look, is there anybody we have to warn to be careful not to take this vaccine particularly? Is there a subpopulation or, existing medical condition that might predispose you to these super, super, super rare events? And then be able to go forward with the vaccine again.
Caroline Chen of ProPublica, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Saturday.
Worldwide, teachers and students are finding ways to cope as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to create restrictions on classroom learning. We reported on outdoor schools here in the U.S., and now we have news from Spain, where outside means classes can be a day at the beach. For children at one public school in southeastern Spain, the combination of sea breezes, desks, and chalkboards is a welcome relief.
This is very good because I'm with my friends. I'm at the beach. I love the beach. In summer, I always come here to swim every day, and I love the sand.
I prefer to be on the beach because here I feel more relaxed. I feel more comfortable.
There are 8 groups, and they follow social distancing rules just as they do indoors. But outdoor classes mean there can be some breaks from wearing masks.
We can sit, and if there is no one around us, we can take off our mask and breathe in the fresh air.
Being outside also brings hands-on lessons from local residents.
People from the village, fishermen, taught the students how to fish, how to live. They identified the economy that is suffering so much and how they themselves have been able to feed us in times of pandemic. It is very important for them to know that fish are not in the supermarket, that fish are in the sea, and we have to catch them.
Teachers say the sun and the sea are good for everyone in a country where COVID has claimed close to 77,000 lives.
It's saved. Children are having a great fun. They are like unbelievable learning, because what they learn here, they don't forget. It's something, it's unbelievable.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfein Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.